Hi, Chris.
Okay. Hey, Connor.
How's it going?
It's good. I think we're on. I think we're recording.
I think so too. As we were just talking about, it's weird to be recording a conversation where we're not seeing each other, but I guess that's what everyone says about blogging heads.
Yeah, well, it's almost like real TV. I think that's how it works on the networks too. So we can pretend this is ABC.
I'm pretending already. So do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, and then I'll introduce myself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Chris Beam. I work at Slate Magazine, which is where I am right now. I write about politics, and I work in the D.C. office. Who are you?
I'm Connor Clark. I work for The Atlantic Monthly, where I'm not right now. I'm actually in my room in our house, because we're roommates, which I guess goes to show that
that's true.
Journalism in D.C. is as incestuous as everyone believes. I write about business and politics for the Atlantic website, and before that I was the editor of Creative Capitalism with Mike Kinsley, which is a book and web project about global development. Do you want to...
I'll sort of lay out real quick what we want to talk about. First, you know, because Connor's at the Atlantic, I'm at Slate, we want to talk a little bit about where both those publications are going and sort of future journalism, that kind of thing, because people just don't talk about that enough. We want to get to the stimulus, because Obama gave a speech last night, his press conference, and talk about the Senate bill. And then we want to get to the RNC, Michael Steele, the problems he's been having. And then finally, A-Rod and Michael Phelps, who's worse, or who's better.
Michael Phelps.
So stick around if you want to hear about those. And Connor, you wanna sort of lead us in?
Sure. So one thing that's interesting for me, looking at Slate and The Atlantic, is that we seem to be copying you. Basically, you guys seem to have an editorial strategy that said we'll start with this mothership called Slate, and then we'll build out into all these little constituent sites. And you guys have now, I think, the big money and the root, and you're starting one for women, I think, called XX. And
I think it's gonna be called Double X.
Double X, right? And The Atlantic is doing more or less the same thing. We've got a mothership called TheAtlantic.com, and we've got all these bloggers there. And now what we're trying to do is we're trying to build out all these miniature sites that organize that content. So we've got Atlantic Business and Atlantic Politics, and soon we'll have Atlantic Culture and Atlantic Food, and then hopefully more. And I guess an interesting question is why.
It seems like the main difference is just the creativity of the names of the sites.
Right. People at The Atlantic are not creative. I guess the best we can do is come up with things like...
Atlantic News.
Atlantic, right. Right.
Atlantic
Business.
Words.
Not as good. Not as good as the big money. But that's okay. We're derivative. But why are we derivative, Chris? What's going on at Slate? Why are you guys doing this?
I actually cornered our publisher earlier today just to get the official line on this, and I don't really know any state secrets, so it's the basic explanation for what Slate's doing and why it's starting all these new sites in an economic recession is that the model has worked. The model of having display ads on a free site and letting people see content for free has worked, apparently. And what they're trying to figure out now is whether they can scale that, because in the grand scheme, Slate's still pretty small. So the idea is that, say we wanted to add a lot of business coverage, it wouldn't make sense to put it on Slate's main site and have 40% of the articles there be business. It makes much more sense to give people a separate homepage that they can go to, which has its own branding advantages, and it helps with advertisers because you can say, you're targeting people who probably have a higher income and know a lot more about business, know what your company is.
Right. I think the for us, the sort of branding for advertisers thing is quite critical. I guess the big switch for us last week was Mark Amender, who's our politics blogger, a really great sort of reported politics blogger, switched his blog. It used to be called Mark Amender, a reported blog on politics. And now it's called Politics with Mark Amender. And I guess...
A reported blog by Mark Amender.
Right, a reported blog by Mark Amender. And it might seem like an utterly sort of frivolous switch, but little I know about advertising online actually suggests that it's not at all frivolous, that advertisers feel far and away more comfortable advertising on something called Atlantic Politics than they do advertising on something called Mark Amender. So to some extent...
And that kind of makes sense, yeah. Because, like, I... You and I know and love Mark Amender, but, you know, some rando who's just coming to the Atlantic site sees on the side a bunch of names they don't recognize. They don't know, oh, like, here's a libertarian, here's the political reporter. So that makes sense to me.
Right, and I guess, you know, there's also... It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see whether this changes, but I know from the meetings I've been in about advertising online, there's still a lot of discomfort with the idea of advertising on a blog. So Andrew Sullivan, you know, has millions and millions and millions of readers, but I'm not sure his advertising is commensurate to the size of his readership. And I think one of the things we want to try and
do... So you just don't call it a blog and that's all
right,
the problem?
Right, is basically to lie or to try and trick advertisers into thinking we have something that's not a blog when it in fact is just a blog with a bunch of baubles. So we've got a business
right.
blog or a politics blog, but we want to make it look like a real website. We want to say this is more than a blog, it's you know, Atlantic Politics.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about we've been talking about this model of just pure display advertising, and I think Atlantic and Slate are lucky in that their readerships are pretty dedicated and, you know, like higher than average wealth and pretty educated, and so they're an attractive group to advertisers. But what about sites for whom that doesn't work?
Right.
There was
that
Time Magazine cover story about, like, alternate models. Like, which do you think works best?
Yes, this is interesting. So this is good. We can sort of briefly talk about all the proposals that seem like they've been shoved out the door in the past week for the future of journalism. And one is the one you've mentioned, which was Walter Isaacson's big story in Time about the future of news consumption. And basically, if I've got the story correct, he proposes a model of the newspaper that's modeled after iTunes. So it'll be an incremental pay system. You'll click on a link for an article, and when you click on the link for an article, you'll be prompted in some very brief, presumably user-friendly way, to pay, you know, half of a cent for that article or a nickel for that article. And the idea is basically to change the culture of news consumption, that consuming music online for a long time used to be something that people would only do if it was free, and it started with Napster, as everyone knows, and BitTorrent and things like that. And I think the consensus now is something like iTunes has been relatively successful in changing that and getting people to pay some incremental cost per song. So I think on iTunes right now it's 99 cents per song, and no one buys albums anymore. And I think Walter Isaacson's idea is to have a price per story, and make it not the case that people buy newspapers; they just buy individual stories for some incremental fee. I don't know if that'll work. What do you think?
Well, there have been a couple of experiments in that already. I mean, I know Anna Marie Cox had a similar model during the campaign where, at least towards the end, she had a little widget or something on her page that let people give however much they wanted. It's like, you know, the journalism equivalent of the Radiohead album.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it worked. You know, I think people gave her money. It costs so much to travel with the campaign, and
although that,
covering those costs must have been a pain.
I think that's slightly different from what Isaacson's describing. What you seem to be describing
there.
Yeah,
right. This is, I guess this is voluntary that I'm describing. I think that's a good idea. I always thought that, like, the one way to fight downloading of music is to just make it so easy that, like, it's so intuitive that your grandma can do it.
So do you use iTunes
no
or
confusion.
BitTorrent?
Well, I'm not my grandma, so... you know, some of us have some other things figured out. I don't know. There's probably some sort of liability to talking about these things on blogging.
Which is to say, you use BitTorrent.
That's possible. And then, yeah, voluntarily just send checks to the bands. I actually think that... So I think that model works of the micro donation or micro payments based on what you want to read. The problem with that, though, is that I think it rewards a certain kind of journalism, and it doesn't work as much for another.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, it works if it works for small, like micro breaking news, where you say like, oh, I see that this article has a piece of information in it that I want. I'm going to pay 5 cents and go read it.
Mm-hmm.
What I think it doesn't work for is longer pieces where the value of it comes from having read it, and you don't really know if it's going to be good before you mm-hmm. go in, and probably cost more to produce, so you'd have to charge more.
That's interesting. And couldn't we imagine something like what iTunes does with videos, where it costs, I don't know, what, $2.99 to download a music video? And in any event, with all these things...
Yeah, but would you pay $2.99 for a long-form, like, New Yorker piece?
Oh, no, but it would be...
Yeah, it might be good, might be lame,
well,
you know.
Well, I guess two things. One is it would be scaled appropriately. So if a song is 99 cents and a music video is $2.99, we could imagine the iTunes of journalism having something like a newspaper article that is a cent and a New Yorker article or a New York Times Magazine article that is 5 cents. Mm-hmm. That would be, that for all I know, that could be complete apocryphal bullshit, but
yeah,
I mean,
guess
some
so,
kind
but
of
it's,
scale
it
like
seems...
that would be presumably more appropriate.
I just don't know if 5 cents an article is going to be enough to cover the cost mm-hmm. that real investigative reporting requires. Mm-hmm. And right now, but, they've got, mm-hmm. like, the New York Times has the luxury of, you know, Chanel and, like, all the other advertisers in the T magazine. And I don't, without that, I don't know if there are enough people willing to pay 5 cents or even readership to cover that.
Right. But I guess that's
what we have to figure out.
In principle, the idea, the kind of subsidy model of journalism that you're describing, where, you know, the Thursday style section and the Sunday style section subsidize the Baghdad Bureau, doesn't necessarily have to be different if it's going to be the Isaacson model, I guess, because we could imagine a situation where thousands and thousands of people or millions and millions of people download at incremental cost the style section article. And that mm-hmm. subsidizes the smaller number of people that download the long reported piece from Baghdad or the investigative article by the investigative team about wiretaps or whatever.
Right.
The idea of subsidies across the industry I don't think needs to change. It's really just what's going to be producing that subsidy. And in the model you just described, it's the advertising and the style pages, and in the model that Isaacson describes, I guess one can imagine it would just be the greater demand for style pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Those things.
What I like about it is that it's pure meritocracy. You know, like you can never blame your editor for not giving you good enough placement, or you can never blame sort of systemic factors. Like it really just is. If it's good, people will read it, and they'll hear about it, and they'll pay for it.
But I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, it seems strange to conflate the idea of merit with having the highest number of readers. I mean, I think you would want to say, and I would want to say certainly, that even a piece, a serious reported piece about Darfur or something like that, that mm-hmm. does not attract a large number of readers, to some extent has merit of a very different and presumably more valuable sort than an article about, I don't know, Britney Spears or whatever else in the style section that attracts thousands or millions of readers.
And there, you're right, there might be another incentive to produce something that's going to get a million clicks.
Right.
But the thing is, that incentive already exists in the current model, so
yeah,
I don't think it would necessarily be any worse.
There's no escaping the perverse incentives, I guess. If it's either trying to serve advertisers or trying to serve the whims of readers, and I guess... It just sort of seems like the question is always, what's the way of minimizing that cost in such a way as to subsidize the strong medicine? You know, the pieces that are mm-hmm. that are important for democracy, the sort of
right.
state pieces.
I mean, I think Obama has actually set aside some money in the
bailout
package for that. But before we move on to that, you should mention so we've been talking about the micropayments and.
Right,
display ads.
There are plenty
this
of other models.
Model.
The Isaacson piece was just one of what seems like four different suggestions or theories of the future of print journalism or the future of serious journalism that have come out in the past week. And one is the Isaacson. And then the other three, I guess, let me see if I can rattle them off. One is the op-ed piece that was in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago. And it was a piece by the money managers at Yale. And it basically proposed... funding a newspaper on the model of a university, presumably a successful university with a large endowment like Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I can cite them chapter and verse, but I think basically what they propose is raising an endowment for the New York Times or raising an endowment for the Washington Post, and that would that would give them some nest egg against which they could pay the annual costs of reporting. And it would also free them from all sorts of tax liabilities and presumably make it easier for them to run. So that was one. The other ideas are, let's see, one was Newsweek's. I think just yesterday there was a piece in the New York Times about Newsweek has a plan basically to scale back the number of readers in its magazine and charge an astronomically higher rate. I think the piece in the New York Times about it said that the average Newsweek subscriber now pays about $25 for the magazine, and that they imagine at some point in the future, a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, the average subscriber is going to be paying $50 for that magazine. So it'll bring down the number of subscribers, but it'll bring up the revenue per subscriber. And then the last model was the New York Times one. And the New York Times published this big, long piece about itself yesterday. I think it was Richard Perez Pena that wrote it. And it basically said the strategy of the New York Times is to be the last man or woman standing, that the New York Times thinks there's going to be all sorts of ad revenue out there. And it wants to, maybe this is paraphrasing somewhat, but it wants to be the very last newspaper that can reap all these ad revenues. They think there's going to be a big market benefit to outlasting a lot of papers that are absorbing a lot of ad revenue. So those are three other ideas for how. I don't know if any of those are good, but what do you think?
I guess the New York Times as like the blob that absorbs, you know, the ad. Advertisers from the Tribune Company and all these other places, it should work in the short term at least, because you know, as they say, like the newspapers are dying, but they're dying in the slow, really lucrative way. And so, you know, anytime someone goes under, then everyone else comes over and like feeds on the corpse. That's great. I feel like it's not necessarily enough to sustain it long term, because of
the last man
the
standing
fact that
model.
If all I'm not sure the last man standing model works in the long term because of all these other models we've been describing and the fact that they might be mixing in advertising with say the micropayments or with the endowment model. And so I don't think that the New York Times is going to have, like, the entire news industry to itself.
Yeah, or maybe, you know, a more sort of pressing problem with the last man standing theory of the New York Times is I think a lot of us want a world in which there is more than one person standing.
Did you say water world?
I wish. I think I said we want a world.
Yeah. I was hoping that would be
We also want Waterworld, but we want a world, I think, in which there's more than one newspaper around. And to some extent, the New York Times theory seems to presume something that I think a lot of us, especially those of us in journalism, would find kind of disgusting, which is the mass closure of plenty of newspapers. And I think, you know, maybe that's just a market inevitability, but the cost that I think a lot of people are thinking about is local news reporting. It would be perfectly fine if the New York Times continued to exist, and I think most people would find it a bit hard to imagine a world in which the New York Times company didn't exist in some form, doing news gathering in some form. But it sort of seems like the last man standing strategy would be bad for the Cleveland Plain Dealer or the Philadelphia Inquirer or the Chicago Tribune or any of those newspapers that might break
important
stories about scandals in local and state and regional politics and so on.
But the secret solution to that is that a lot of local papers that only report on local things are doing just fine, or if not just fine,
true?
keeping their head above water. Yeah, I mean, I think that papers that know their specific areas are doing okay. It's the fact that, you know, the Boston Globe is closing all these overseas bureaus, and local papers that try to also be national papers are finding that that's not possible.
Oh, I see. Okay, I mean, to some extent, I would need to check. You know, one of my best friends from college works for the Times Star Ledger in New Jersey, and I think, you know, 3 months ago or something, they fired or bought out 40% of the people in their newsroom. And to some extent, that implies, I don't know, at least anecdotally, a problem with the industry, the kind of large-ish regional papers, beyond just trying to sustain an insustainable Washington bureau or Baghdad bureau or Istanbul bureau or London bureau. Or but maybe not. I hope you're right.
One question, and then maybe we should move on.
Yeah,
is
sure.
the piece about the endowment model for the New York Times or any paper, it mentioned that a good size of the endowment would have to be, you know, $5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how much Rupert Murdoch paid for the journal?
I don't.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong here. I don't think it was that much, but it was a lot. And I think it was in the billions, right?
I am hesitant to commit myself to a number. I would guess that it would be just about $1 billion, that maybe it was a bit over $1 billion.
I think it was more than that. I think it was an absurd amount. I think it was like four or five billion. And I apologize if I'm getting this wrong, but if that's true, we can sort of like set.
But
this
I'm also
aside.
I mean, you know, I'm also not sure did he pay for it. He didn't just hand over a suitcase with $1 billion in it. He presumably paid it in, you know, stock and various other assets.
Sure, sure. But if you're even in that ballpark,
mm-hmm.
I mean, why not just set up, like, he can clearly, I think he has that much. I mean,
mm-hmm.
why not just set up
an
endowment?
Or Carlos Slim or something, or Bill Gates or something like that. Why doesn't Bill Gates just buy the New York Times?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, $5 billion seems like a lot, but considering that Murdoch paid almost that much for the journal, it seems like, you know, why not just go with that model right away? Why dither through these other sort of unsustainable or at least experimental models when this is there.
Right. Well, that's a good thought. I guess that's a good thought to close the section on. If there was a reasonable counter thought, I think it would be that most people would be more comfortable with the idea of a New York Times that had an endowment funded by thousands of middle-sized grantmakers rather than just one big grantmaker. I think they would want at least some reassurance from the funding side that it was going to have the accountability distributed somewhat across more than one person. I don't know if anyone would be that satisfied with the Bill Gates Times or with the Warren Buffett Times.
Sure.
But maybe, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's what can be said? It worked reasonably well for The Atlantic, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This is why they know, but The Atlantic is owned by David Bradley, and David Bradley is someone who made hundreds of millions of dollars in consulting and sold off his consulting businesses in the mid-90s and decided
right.
that he was gonna fund magazines. So The Atlantic is,
yeah.
is one beneficiary of that model. So,
well, I guess every publication should have someone like that, and then we'll all be fine.
A rich uncle.
I feel bad because I wasted my segue earlier. My segue was going to be, you know, Obama should clearly put something in the stimulus package for...
But we were instructed it's okay to have terrible, terrible segues, so...
Speaking about the stimulus package... for bad segues.
Right.
Well, that was a very
stimulating discussion we just had about newspapers. Speaking of other things that... No, okay.
All right. Let's go with that.
All right.
Other stimulating things. So last night, Obama gave this press conference... the first big one at the White House since the inauguration, and he basically gave this 10-minute sell on the Senate stimulus bill, and
mm-hmm.
A lot of people thought that it was a week too late. You know, he should have done this a week ago, or if not before that, just come out and give a very clear, lucid explanation of why we need to be spending $800-900 billion on government spending.
Do you agree with that? Do you think he's done a bad job of selling the stimulus?
I actually don't think it's been that terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people were saying that he should have come out earlier and just said, this is going to cost a ton of money, we're going to spend it, deal with it. Spending is the point of stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And he did say that yesterday, and maybe he should have said that earlier, but I actually think his approach hasn't been as bad as everyone says. You know, the reaching out to Republicans was all this, there was all this, like, drama and theater about it, but, and it didn't end up yielding much at all. It got them 3 Republican votes, and there are all these concessions in the bill. Mm. But I think he made a good point last night, which is that this is laying the groundwork for the tone of the administration. Like, if he does...
offering concessions that are then ignored is laying the groundwork?
No, I mean, going in and having Republicans over to the White House and sort of having this be a culture where you try and emphasize working together rather than working against each other. And so I think that might be partially artificial, and it's always going to feel artificial, but I think that if he keeps doing that, it's one thing if he just does that now and gives up. I think if he keeps doing that over a long period of time, it might end up really yielding benefits. Well, I mean, how do you think?
Well, I guess, okay, so to some extent I agree with that. I think Obama's done a pretty good job selling the stimulus, although there are 2 ways you can look at it. One is, you know, there was this big Gallup poll, I think, that came out either yesterday or over the weekend, saying that a slim majority of Americans support the stimulus, and those that have negative views about how the stimulus has proceeded have far and away more negative views of how congressional Republicans have behaved than of either how Obama has behaved or how congressional Democrats have behaved. So to some extent, I think that bodes quite well for the theory that Obama has done a good job selling the stimulus. On the other hand, I think you could look at the very same polling data in something like Gallup, or Rasmussen has had a number of polls about this, and say there's a big, big difference between how well Obama as a president polls versus how well the stimulus polls. In other words, far more Americans think favorable thoughts about Obama as the president than they think favorable thoughts about the stimulus package. And you might say that gap implies that he hasn't done as good a job as he might have. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how sympathetic I am to that argument. I think he's done a pretty good job. And I think the fact that most people support a spending bill, even though, you know, decades of Washington speak has more or less trained them to you know, be very suspicious of large spending bills, I think says pretty good things about what Obama's done. On the other hand,
what about? Oh,
no,
go ahead.
No. I was going to say, on the other hand, I find it, some of what Obama says I find mildly annoying, and I guess, you know, it's certainly true that he offered some concessions to Republicans. It's certainly true he could have proposed a bill that was composed entirely of direct and appropriated spending and had no tax cuts in it at all. But it's a bit disingenuous to say, maybe I should have done that, as I think he did last night, and then ratcheted up the number of tax cuts from there to make it look like I was appeasing congressional Republicans. For one, you know, his advisors have never proposed doing something like that, and his advisors don't think that would be the best stimulus.
Right. They're a lot more moderate. Yeah. Presumably than he is.
I mean, Larry Summers has never said, Christina Romer has never said, none of these people have ever said, we want a bill that is entirely direct and appropriated spending and contains no tax cuts. That's just not the case. The second thing that I sort of found mildly annoying is Obama likes to say things like, and I can't quote him exactly from what he said last night, but in response to some question after his talk, he basically said, there is extremely widespread consensus among economists, among professionals and experts, that his sort of bill is what the country needs. And you know, I think that
spending is better than tax cuts, right?
Right,
the basic gist.
That giant fiscal policy, you know, some large bill of spending and tax cuts is what everyone thinks is a good idea. As opposed to monetary policy, as opposed to, you know, screwing around with the money supply and the federal funds rate and so on. Everyone agrees fiscal policy is the way to go. And I just don't think it's true that everyone thinks giant fiscal policy is the way to go. He might say, we think we're right. And he might say, there's a majority of macroeconomists that think a giant fiscal stimulus bill like this one is the way to go. But to some extent,
you think there's a lot more debate than he gave credit for.
I think that's basically right. And you know, look no further than something like this morning in the Wall Street Journal. I think Gary Becker and Kevin Murphy at the University of Chicago mm-hmm. had a long op-ed basically being skeptical, slightly skeptical, if not very skeptical, of fiscal stimulus.
Right.
And, you know, Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman, I'm sure if they haven't written blog posts already, they will later today, saying Gary Becker and Kevin Murphy are idiots. They're totally wrong
right.
in the piece. You know, Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman might be right. I might think they're right. You might think they're right. But the fact that Gary Becker, you know, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and Kevin Murphy, who I think won the John Bates Clark Medal, the fact that they're
right,
writing a piece like this certainly indicates that there isn't consensus among economists. And I think, you know, Obama shouldn't say there's consensus among economists.
Well, and here's the weird thing, sort of jumping off of that, is that clearly there's disagreement, but then, you know, you look at what the Republicans were offering as their alternative, what the 36 Republicans voted for as their alternative stimulus bill was, what, like $3 trillion all tax cuts, I'm pretty sure. And so
yeah, okay.
it's even the idea of bipartisan compromise seems sort of odd and potentially impossible if, on the one hand, you've got Paul Krugman and other liberal economists saying, oh, you know, this is clearly not big enough. There's, you know, fiscal spending is going to be much more effective than tax cuts, and it needs to be as big as possible. And on the other hand, you've got Republicans saying, we need entirely tax cuts. It's not even like they're
yeah.
different points on the spectrum. They're the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Right.
Which makes the idea of reaching out to the other party and sort of these peons to bipartisanship, if that's how you pronounce the word, it makes it seem a little weird or disingenuous if there actually is no halfway point. I mean, you might remember during the negotiations, George Voinovich he was part of the conversation, the Republican, and he dropped out. He was just like, I can't be part of this. We're not talking about the same philosophy here.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of said to me that maybe the idea that you can compromise on this is a little unrealistic in the first place.
Yeah, I don't know.
And that says weird things about Obama's entire agenda for bipartisanship.
Right. I think, you know, Tyler Cowen had a post this morning on Marginal Revolution that I think I didn't have a chance to read seriously, but basically I think he's a stimulus skeptic. I think that's mm-hmm. a fair characterization. Who thinks that the theory of fiscal policy is respectable. And to me that
is respectable.
Is respectable, yeah. And to me that implies
right, sure.
if there are people like Tyler Cowen in the world, to me it implies that there is room for something resembling bipartisan consensus. On the mm-hmm. other hand, there are people like Robert Barrow, who I talked mm-hmm. to last week.
Who you interviewed, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, basically...
he does not seem to be a fan of Paul Krugman.
No, he doesn't seem to be a fan of Paul Krugman. And he doesn't seem to be a fan of fiscal policy at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, I think when I kind of asked him what he'd like to see instead, his suggestion was not temporary fiscal stimulus. It was permanent rate cuts, permanent mm-hmm. tax rate cuts, basically the Bush 2003 model of stimulus.
Right.
And, you know, that to me implies that there is some segment of the economics population that is not going to be amenable
right.
to bipartisanship but compromise.
Can I ask you a question? Because this is actually one of my biggest frustrations with this whole debate, is that you've got super intelligent people like Robert Barrow on one hand saying, you know, tax cuts only. Then on the other hand, you've got Paul Krugman saying, you know, fiscal stimulus only. I mean, clearly smart people have completely polar opposite views of how this should work. And my reaction has been basically a sort of nihilism. It's like... you'll hear people making the case that the New Deal didn't work. Like Mitch McConnell just yesterday said that the New Deal ended up like hurting the economy more than it helped it. Everyone knows that it was actually World War II that stimulated the economy.
Mm-hmm.
There, whereas liberals will say, oh, well, you know, the economy actually there was a slump during FDR's term because he didn't spend enough. It wasn't that that he drove into the ground, it's that he didn't do enough fiscal stimulus. And so you've got these totally opposite explanations for the same phenomenon. People so emotional and ideological about it on both sides. And to someone who doesn't have a degree in economics, this just sounds like, it sounds like religion. You know, it sounds like you can just believe whatever you want to believe, and there'll be people who support your argument, and there just seems very little grounding in rational argument. And I know that there is grounds for rational argument, and you know, economists can agree on certain core principles, but from listening, it's been so frustrating to have economists just contradicting each other, but not just that, but like not even acknowledging the legitimacy of other economists' points to give people who don't know a lot about economists something to grab onto and to say, like, okay, well, here's some common ground we can talk about.
Right. I think there are basically two ways about that. One is you can take the evidence you just laid out and say there is a mass failure in professional economics to arrive at anything resembling even an approximate consensus about the most basic and fundamental questions, like what happens to the economy when the government spends a dollar versus the government cuts taxes by a dollar. That's one interpretation. I think there's a lot of strong evidence in favor of that interpretation. Another interpretation is basically what Paul Krugman seems to be doing, which is to say, and you brought up religion, you know, so does he, and basically he says,
really?
I think he basically says what's happening now in the economics profession is more or less analogous to creationism, that you know, there should be a profession called biology, and there should be a profession called economics that obeys certain widely agreed upon rules, and people that are staking out various positions in economics, and I think he singles out people like Eugene Fama at the University of Chicago, are staking out positions analogous to someone adopting creationism in a biology department.
And meaning that there's just not enough legitimate empirical evidence to back it up,
he's saying it requires
a leap of faith.
They're calling night day. They're making such basic elementary mistakes in economics that I think the term that he's used or Mark Thome has used or some of these other economics bloggers have used is a line in the sand needs to be drawn. People basically need to say.
Right.
On one side of this line is the profession of economics, and on the other side of this line is Eugene Fama and people that claim any government spending crowds out private investment on a one-to-one basis. I kind of think, you know, Paul Krugman is probably right in the particular circumstance he's describing, and Brad DeLong is probably right in the particular circumstance he's describing. But I don't know. I mean, it makes the debate over the stimulus a kind of fearsome thing, that you see analogies to, you know, the Scopes trial.
I think that it does give lay people a certain lack of faith in economists, and I know that people think of economics as a science rather than a social science, sometimes to a fault.
Maybe they should stop doing that, I guess.
I think they probably should. But it still seems like something that should be more resistant to politicizing than something like healthcare. Well, yeah, something like healthcare or something where people can legitimately disagree on the best way to deliver a service.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, is there anything else you wanted to touch on here? I mean, I could pretend to be Paul Krugman, and you could pretend to be Greg Mankiw, or we could just talk about their beef. Okay.
Hey, sorry about that. I switched off my video for a second.
That's okay. I don't think people like looking at you anyway. But it's amazing what technology can do these days. It can just like splice them together.
Right.
So you want to just pick up? I guess we should probably move on to the next topic.
Right, which is, so we're done with the stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, if there's one other point I can make about the stimulus, it's just to be a shill for my my favorite issue of all, which is the alternative minimum tax, and the big difference, and I think it's worth mentioning because I think it's just so utterly crazy. The biggest single difference between the House version of the stimulus bill and the Senate version of the stimulus bill is that the Senate contains a $70 billion one-year extension of the AMT patch. And everyone is saying these two bills are the same size, $820 billion, but composed slightly differently. Mm-hmm. And it's not true. It's not worth thinking about the Senate bill as $820 billion when it contains $70 billion in what no one is claiming is stimulus spending. The alternative minimum tax is not in any sense targeted stimulus.
Why does this make you mad?
Well, because it creates a public perception that the Senate bill is $820 billion mm-hmm. and the House bill is $820 billion, and it's just a matter of sorting out the details.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the AMT will be in the final version?
I hope not.
Mm-hmm. The AMT
I don't know.
Patch.
It's hard to tell. On the one hand, it's a popular thing to patch. On the other hand, it's something that would get passed anyway as part of the normal legislative process, and it doesn't need to be included at
all.
So
you think they included it in there to be able to say that they're putting in more tax credits than they otherwise did?
Yeah.
The tax credit that already existed?
I think, you know, the other thing that's bothering is it's slightly disingenuous. I think it was included for two reasons. One is it lets Democrats say, look, we included all this additional tax cutting, mm-hmm. $70 billion in additional tax cutting. Mm-hmm. And the other reason it's included is because it makes it look like the bill is paying out faster than it actually does. If you remember way back when the stimulus debate started, the standard that the Obama administration was supposed to apply, I think Peter Ortzag was the person who said it, was that the bill was going to pay out 75% of the total in the first 18 months.
Right.
And the House version of the bill didn't quite meet that standard. When the CBO issued its report, it found that 64% of the bill was going to pay out in the first 18 months.
So this would boost the amount.
Right. A one-year AMT patch is by definition something that will have an effect in the next fiscal year.
Mm-hmm.
And when the CBO did its analysis of the Senate version of the bill, it found that 78% of the bill would pay out in the first 18 months, which isn't entirely due to the addition of the AMT patch.
But partially.
But a lot of it is due to the addition of the AMT patch. And it just, to me at least, it doesn't make any sense to think about the Senate bill as faster or more effective stimulus or stimulus that contains additional tax cutting when the AMT patch is not going to have any stimulative effect on the economy, mm-hmm. and the AMT patch is something that would pass anyway. But
those
now that
bastards.
I've got my... Yeah, now that I've got my AMT rant out of my system, we can move on.
Are you sure? We could talk about this for the rest of the hour.
I think that would be a great cruelty imposed on anyone who happens to have made it this far.
That's all right.
Already, but I do hope that the House and Senate in committee take the AMT patch out of the Senate version and find another $70 billion to compare to $820 billion comparable bills.
Right. So, but you like the AMT patch in general, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the AMT is a stupid tax. Mm-hmm. I think it would be far better to abolish it. I think everyone knows it would be far better to abolish it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it produces something like $1 trillion in revenue every year. And people are afraid to abolish it because then that requires expanding the tax base in a variety of other ways, and it would just be politically costly to try and do that.
Right. Well, you know, this is great because give me an example of someone who is in favor of the AMT patch.
Everyone's in favor.
Oh, come on! You're supposed to say Michael Steele.
Oh shoot. Okay. Well, this is good though because now the transition is even worse than it otherwise would have been. Michael Steele is in favor of patching the alternative minimum tax. Michael Steele has also fired the entire staff of the RNC, He paid his sister to do various campaign projects that are, well, it's questionable that they were actually accomplished. Mm-hmm. And he has recently claimed that government has not created a single job. So Michael Steele has been in the news recently, and we should talk about him. But, well, I guess the biggest question is, it sort of seemed like Michael Steele, for me, was a great choice. The Republican Party was getting this reputation as a place where it was okay to have things like gift baskets containing the song Barack the Magic Negro distributed. And Michael Steele seemed like a great choice in part because he was representative of a party that was perhaps moving beyond that reputation.
Right.
Now it seems like it's less the case. What do you think? Is Michael Steele...
Is he going to be a disaster? I think it's hard yet to say if he's going to be a total disaster, because I agree with you that he was the only choice. Because he's not Caden Dawson, I think what's amazing is how close they came to picking Caden Dawson. The vote was so close that I think that itself was embarrassing. But
he was sort of the polar opposite.
Yeah, he was the polar opposite. You know, belonged to the all whites country club and came from the South. I think they came just on the brink of disaster when they almost picked him, but they didn't. The problem, though, with Steele is I don't think that this campaign spending thing is necessarily going to do him in. I mean, the reason it was revealed was that a former finance chair of one of his campaigns was trying to get a better deal when the FBI was investigating him for something else. So it's not the most credible claim. That said, it's not a good start for him. He seems to have this really sort of ebullient, belligerent personality that I don't think fits the time right now. I mean, yeah, he's a good choice in the sense that, he can move the party forward and he's African American and he can provide this sort of counterpoint to Obama in that sense. But I think that his personality isn't necessarily the right fit. I mean, one of the first things he said in his acceptance speech was, how do you like me now? Like, he's got this sort of, like, in-your-face style that I don't think... that I think when the contrast is Obama, it's just going to look kind of, like, clownish and silly. Like, for example, that time when he said, a government has never created a single job. I mean, that's...
And then you can't defend the claim. I think he made it, and it was sort of, maybe it was funny and ha-ha, and,
Oh, right.
You could sort of make the point that, some people would say, government spending in a full employment economy crowds up private investment, and it would be better to have that money in the hands of private business owners so they can create jobs.
Right. But that's not what he said.
that's not what he said. Or it seemed like, even if you could have put that spin on what he said at first, he then went on George Stephanopoulos' show and really, I mean, stuck around the trench for the massacre. I mean,
yeah, but you're saying he kept pushing that point.
Yes, he kept, George Stephanopoulos said, "What about teachers? What about what about yourself as the lieutenant governor of the state?"
Was that not a real job?
Was that not a job?
Policy-wise, I think that obviously is totally silly. But politically, I don't think that's necessarily a bad move. Like saying that something that's totally oversimplified is probably the wisest choice at this point because some people are fed up with the stimulus package and TARP and coming out strong against government is probably the best thing he can do. But the reason I don't think that he can be particularly effective in his term is that I think there's only so much you can do in his position. The Republican Party, you can build up infrastructure and you can get better email lists and do more grassroots organizing and set up more accessible information databases and websites. But I think they still need this inciting moment. Like, they need Obama to screw up. They need him to do something that really pisses off Republicans. And not just spending too much money, because the Democrats can just point to Bush and say he did that too.
It's easy to overstate his value as a figurehead, even if he didn't say anything at all and just sat around and existed as the first black RNC chairman? It would
be just as powerful.
Is there not some value there for the party? He's the leader of the party.
I think there is value to him as a figurehead. I don't think there's much value to what he can do structurally with the organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, he abandoned their idea to start a think tank just recently. I mean, cleaning shop is, that's not necessarily a terrible idea. It might be a good thing. But I think what the Republican Party needs isn't necessarily, I mean, they do need better databases and better phone lists, but and more donations. But what they also need is a narrative and a story about how Obama is ruining this country. And I think that can only develop over time. I don't think that's going to happen right away. And it's certainly not going to happen because Michael Steele is, like, yelling at him on the Sunday shows. I don't think that's an effective way to build their case.
Right. It's like when that moment comes, when it seems like there's an occasion for constructing a narrative about how Obama is screwing up the country, it is going to be a much more effective narrative when it comes from the first black chairman of the RNC than when it comes from some guy who was a member of an all-white country club.
Yeah, that's true. But I also think that he doesn't... I mean, do you agree with me on the sort of, like, over-the-top, like, belligerent style? Like, I feel like Obama's biggest strength is being able to keep his cool even in the most tense circumstances. And even if he's really screwed up, he will say it, and he'll sort of pass it off in this way that's very low blood pressure.
I guess I...
And I think it could make Steele
I don't know. I haven't spent that much time thinking about Steele. I guess the only thing I can say is I remember in 2006 when he was running for Senate and lost narrowly. He seemed very charismatic. He had that extremely cute series of ads. He seemed very articulate.
Careful.
Like clean, right. storybook, etc.
But you said...
He was extremely impressive. And I think there was consensus in the establishment that he was very impressive. And it was sort of... I think he was sort of thought of in the way that maybe Mike Huckabee was thought of. Where the way he was charismatic was not the way that Barack Obama is charismatic. But he was very funny and outgoing and had a great smile. I don't necessarily equate that with belligerence, although maybe that's changed.
I don't think you should equate those two. I think that's just a separate quality that he's displayed. There's also this really funny aspect to him that Gawker sort of picked up on, that he is like, it's like, he is a 50-year-old black man who drops lingo from, like, the early and late 90s.
Oh, bling.
Like, you saw his bling-bling comment. It's like, no one says that anymore,
right.
Like, except ironically, and except unless they're, like, over the age of 45.
And he wasn't saying it ironically.
It's the kind of thing Obama would never say. It's hard to tell if he's, trying. It seems like he's not saying it in a self-conscious way, or he's conscious of it, but it still comes off as a little
maybe it's just the fact that we
trying hard to
that
be
we
hit.
Saw Notorious last week, which
maybe
maybe
what?
It was the fact that we saw Notorious last week, which contained a lot of bling.
Maybe Michael Steele saw Notorious.
Michael Steele,
last
yeah,
week,
but I thought that was sort of funny when he said that. Maybe that's stupid. It probably is stupid. I guess it was a stupid comment.
I don't know. It seems like he's trying hard to play up the fact that he's the other black guy.
Should we talk about our other Michael Phelps? I'm not a very big sports fan. I've never gotten the sense that you were.
I try and pass, but usually fail.
Yeah. I don't have a whole lot to say about this. But it's interesting. You know, I think there's some sort of double standard out there, and maybe it's just standards need to clarify themselves a bit. But
you're talking about Phelps and A-Rod.
Phelps and A-Rod,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Where it just seems crazy to me that Michael Phelps has been punished by the American Swimmers Association or whatever it is, and Alex Rodriguez is not. Now that I don't know anything about baseball, really. I guess it doesn't seem to be the case that baseball had a rule in 2001 and 2002 and 2003 when presumably Alex Rodriguez was taking performance-enhancing drugs. So to that extent, he's not. The letter of the law clears him. Still, it seems to me that no one is making the claim that Michael Phelps's drug use is performance-enhancing. You know, if anything, it is detrimental to his performance.
Well, I was thinking if they take away your medals for using performance-enhancing drugs, should they give you more
medals
Should
he now have 16?
Drugs?
Yeah, I.
But he has to prove that he smoked weed the day of his races. If he can do that, then he gets more medals.
I don't know. I mean,
or at least more admiration.
You know, it seems fine to me. You know, Kellogg's can do whatever it wants. It's a private market for advertising, and if they want to drop their endorsement deals, that's perfectly fine. If other people want to keep their endorsement deals, that's perfectly fine too.
I was pleased to see that Subway kept presumably because they don't want to alienate the stoner market.
No, I mean that would be terrible. I mean Subway is fantastic. It's open late and they've got this $5 sub deal now.
I wouldn't be surprised if you go to some Subways and order like combo number 11 and they give you like a little baggie with your $5 for long.
Yeah, no, I mean it's been nice. I mean. You know, I think it's weird that Kellogg's dropped its sponsorship, although it's perfectly fine that they can do it. But I don't understand, I mean, just to go back to the actual sporting associations, I don't understand why the Swimming Association is punishing him for this. It doesn't seem like his recreational drug use has any effect on the fairness of the sport of swimming. It does seem like Alex Rodriguez's professional drug use has an obvious effect on notions of fairness as they apply to baseball. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, it's never easy to draw a line between performance-enhancing behaviors that are fair and unfair. You know, there's all sorts of artificial things that these ballplayers do, you know, surgeries for their shoulders and, you know,
LASIK.
Yeah, LASIK, sure.
Seriously, there's a really good article. I think my colleague Will Salatan wrote a few years ago about how LASIK does much more for your game as a baseball player than steroids ever could.
But I see those pieces not as being the knockdown case against keeping steroids out of sports. I just see them as blurring the line between what's kept in and what's kept out. And I don't think anyone is claiming there's going to be a bright line between performance-enhancing behaviors that are perfectly fair and perfectly fine in the sport of baseball and performance-enhancing behaviors that need to be kept out. I don't think anyone's claiming that. But it does seem to me like even if there's a blurry line between what's allowed in and what's allowed out, it's very easy to make an argument for why steroids need to be kept out. It is also very easy to make an argument for why marijuana should be allowed in.
Right, or at least you could say, like, you could make the point that, you know, if Michael Phelps had been caught shoplifting, should he be suspended for three months?
When we were talking about it last night, that was sort of the example that came up. Think of another random crime that has absolutely nothing to do with the sport, you know, driving recklessly. Okay, he would be endangering his health as a swimmer. He would be breaking the law. Does it have any implications for whether or not he should be able to get in the pool? I don't think so. I mean, you might say Michael Phelps is a role model and he's letting down the youth of America or something like that. I mean, maybe there are people making that argument. I don't know.
I feel let down.
Yeah, I mean, that's okay. It is okay to feel let down by this. His job is not to be an inspiration to you, Chris. His job is to win gold medals.
Yeah, well, I mean, I will tell the youth of America that I'm on Quaaludes right now, and I feel great. But it's not my job to as a blogging header right now to be a good example. But I think there is an argument out there for why these should all be legal, whether it's not in general, but in sports. Mm-hmm. Whether like someone needs a doob before the baseball game, or whether they shoot up steroids in order to you know hit more home runs. The analogy right now is it's kind of like I think of it as NASCAR, because in NASCAR they've got this system where there are these engineers who are always coming up with better ways to cheat and to make the car more aerodynamic and to go faster and the engines to work more efficiently. And so there's that side. And then there's the regulators who are always constantly dubbing those new innovations illegal. And so it's this cat and mouse game where they're always trying to catch each other and they're sort of resetting the bar for what's allowed and what's not.
And why? What's the reasoning behind those regulations? Is the reasoning this creates cars that are more unsafe, and we're only willing to tolerate a certain level of dangerousness on the track?
No, I think it's that you have to draw the line somewhere.
In other words, you can't bring a jetpack onto the baseball field.
Right, you can't bring a jetpack onto the raceway. Like, I couldn't, if I was running a sprinting race with you, I couldn't just, like, bring my bike and say that I won. And so you have to define what a car is. And so they're able to do that.
Right.
But with performance-enhancing drugs, I think that the line is much less clear, and in a sense that boosts the argument that, well, maybe you shouldn't draw the line. Maybe you should just have sports players who are probably going to be using these performance-enhancing drugs anyway, because they're always keeping ahead of the regulators. Maybe you should just put that out in the open. You know, I feel like Obama was asked about this last night, actually. He was asked about A-Rod or Phelps. About Rodriguez. Yeah, I think what he would have said if he was being totally frank is, you know, he's all about transparency. Like, why don't you just make it transparent? Like, test everyone, make it transparent who's using drugs and who's not. So, like, you'd be watching the Red Sox, and you know it would show the pitcher's like stats or the batter's batting average, and then right next to it would show like what substance he's abusing, or at that point it would just be using.
I guess you know there are three reasons. Yeah, let's say there are three reasons why that's a bad idea. Maybe there's four. I mean, you know, first of all,
I can preempt you. You're going to say it's like health. It's like setting an example.
Can I say them anyway? I mean, I guess the first thing is even, you know, you would be in favor of presumably some kind of regulation for steroids. It's not like you wouldn't be a pure libertarian about it.
Why not?
Okay, well, I mean, then I suppose, why not? Okay, then you just make the other three reasons that I'm about to give you all the more compelling. You know, reason number one is we as a society say we don't want to give people that compete in these things an incentive to take substances that are damaging to their health. We don't want to set up perverse incentives in that fashion. And I could see you might mitigate the strength of that argument by saying I'm in favor of regulation and not pure openness when it comes to performance-enhancing drugs.
But what if they're doing it anyway and this makes it safer?
Well, I mean, I suppose you shouldn't let perfection be the enemy of good, right? I mean, so you know, some regulations are ineffective. Some people break laws.
Sure.
Those aren't arguments against the laws, right? I mean, that's one.
That's true, but I just I think the law breaking in this case is so widespread. You know, Rodriguez had this great rationale for why he used it. He said, "I got this huge multi-million-dollar contract. I felt so much pressure to perform." You know, you could make an even stronger case if you're like the random right fielder who, you know, wants to make a career for himself but isn't very good. Like, he has even bigger incentive to take these. So if Rodriguez is doing it, you know, why? I think it's the odds are good that everyone's doing it, or almost everyone.
Right. Well, I'm still not sure. I mean, you know, even I suppose you could say the fact that a law is widely broken is an argument in favor of saying there's something wrong with the law. I suppose it's not clear, and it's just, you know, you're asking an empirical question to which I don't know the answer. How many people actually break this particular regulation in the sport of baseball? I don't know.
We don't know, but I think we're going to find out more as, I mean, baseball is finally, like, cracking down on this.
Yeah, and, I would have thought it's substantially less than you're implying it. But maybe I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, it doesn't seem like that affects what are the other two arguments against the system you're describing. And one is the what about children argument. And this is mm-hmm. you know, this argument implies in lots of other contexts. It applies against things like nudity in public, profanity in public, rating systems on movies.
They're shooting up in private.
Rating systems on the public airwaves. And I guess the argument is Alex Rodriguez is a public figure, and he has a set mm-hmm. of obligations that are public. And one of those obligations is he shouldn't give the members of our society who do not operate with perfect rationality an incentive to do things mm-hmm. that harm themselves.
Like now if they want to be like Alex Rodriguez, they're not just going to join the little league team. They're going to, go take HGH.
And
even though that's not what he's
there's doing. An empirical question here too, which is how big of a problem are steroids in high school sports? And I can't remember exactly when it was published, but when these stories first started breaking a couple of years ago with Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire, I think there were empirical answers to this question, and they seem to imply that that steroid abuse in high school sports and college sports was growing. And to me, that implies that there's some merit to that second argument. But the third, I think, argument against the system you're describing is just it just definitionally doesn't qualify as fairness as our society defines fairness, and that's a super cheap argument because it's just making the sociological point that we define fairness in a certain way that excludes steroids. It is unfair for Alex Rodriguez to take steroids. Maybe it is also unfair for Alex Rodriguez or Roger Clemens or anyone to have shoulder surgery or to have LASIK. Maybe that's true, but the fact of the matter is, and it is just...
Or maybe it's unfair for them to, you know, like, I'll be Malcolm Gladwell. Like, it's unfair for them to be born in January or something like that. Yeah.
But it is one of the unfair elements about the world in which we live is that our society makes decisions about species of unfairness that we'll tolerate. And varieties of unfairness that we won't. And one variety mm-hmm. of unfairness that we're willing to tolerate is the month in which you were born and the cutoff date for school. Maybe we shouldn't tolerate that.
I mean, you would say that. You would say, I'm born in December. I don't know about you.
February. So I think...
There you go. I'm sensing some bias in this argument. I take your point, and I think I agree that at some point you have to decide what's fair and what's not. But it seems like with something like this, and, you know, I don't actually really necessarily want to see a world in which all our baseball players are doped up, but I think that there is a decent argument to be made that if they're going to be doing it anyway, they should be doing it safely. It would be sort of a decriminalization, maybe.
Yeah. And in general, I think top-down approaches to questions like this are bad. I mean, I'm enough of a libertarian to say... you want the cap and trade system or the carbon tax instead of the top-down regulation on carbon pollution. And maybe there's some analogous solution here, where instead of top-down controls on these specific things, you can come up with some more carefully tailored regulation mechanism. I don't know. It seems like the bar to clear there is pretty high, and I haven't seen any proposals that clear it. But maybe you'll come up with that great solution for.
Maybe we will. The baseball commissioner will watch this video and change his mind. I think we've been talking for a while, so we should probably let people get back to whatever it is they
want. We should probably get some work done too.
Likewise.
Yeah, but thanks.
I'll probably see you tonight. You know, do you know what you're doing for dinner?
Smoking a bunch of weed and taking some Follies.
And eating some Subway. Let's do that.
Some Subway.
I mean, the eating the Subway. All right. Okay. Sounds good. This was great. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Chris. Take care.